Welcome to episode 185 of Speak Beastie for September 3rd, 2023. I'm Amy.
I'm Anne.
And I'm Marjolaine.
And today we are joined by a very special guest. Say hello to Dag. Hi, Dag.
Hi, Dag.
Hi.
For some backstory, Dag is joining us today because you may have heard them on last week's episode, the Oops All Kowalskis episode. They were the one bringing up the theory from the audience about how Patronuses and Obscurials are like opposite things, sides of the same thing, and it was super cool, so smart. And okay, let me tell you guys a story. So on the Thursday night before LeakyCon, we did this experience at the Cauldron, which is an immersive like wizarding mixology experience in Bucktown here in Chicago. And Marjolaine and I went, and Dag was there. And that night I saw Dag and I was just like, wow, they seem really cool. I can't talk to them. I'm not cool. And the same thing kept happening during the whole week. I would see them and just see their impeccable vibes and be like, oh my God, they're so cool.
Oh, you're gonna make me cry. Not that cool.
And not like, I feel like intimidated because they're so cool. And then like on Sunday after the panel, we were all like so hyped about the cool theory that I basically cornered them in the marketplace. I think you need to be on this show.
That is pretty much what happened, yeah. But I did make it easier for you to justify because I said, you're like, oh yeah, you sound like you had a lot of ideas. I'm like, yeah, here's my notebook, and pulled out
a
binder.
Busted out this notebook. Like there was binders. They were page tabs. Yep. It was incredible.
I love it.
Yeah. It's color coded. It's a problem. You don't want to see my Potter book annotations.
Oh, one of us.
Dag, what is your Hogwarts house?
Slytherin. Easily Slytherin.
Excellent.
Since I was a very small child.
And your Ilvermorny house?
So when I took the tests on Pottermore way back when, I'm a person who takes the tests more than once to make sure that it's a real result because, brief backstory, I was in the beta testing for Pottermore, and there were a million people who got in. That was the limit that they set. And yet somehow there are almost exactly 250,000 students in each house. And that's statistically impossible. So I don't trust the quizzes the first time you take them. So I tried to take it. I took it 4 times and did not get the same house once. So I went with my own choice, which is Horned Serpent, which is also attributing to my Ravenclaw secondary house, because the way that I go after my ambitious things is gathering knowledge. So
I was about to say, are you sure you're Slytherin and not Ravenclaw?
Your primary house is why you do things, and your secondary house is how you do them. So it's like, how do I get where I want to go? I gather knowledge.
I mean,
also thanks for implying that Slytherins can't be smart.
That too, you know.
that's the most cool combination, and the type of combination that is, I mean, you can conquer the world with this type of thing. Like ambition and knowledge to concrete your ambition. That's very impressive.
I think I have a button from Draco and the Malfoys that says, knowledge is power, power corrupts, study hard, be evil.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a very easy line to go down. But anyway, but I'd say that my Ilvermorny house is Horned Serpent.
Nice, nice. All the snakes. Okay. And what is your favorite beast?
The Demiguise, which also has a very, very brief, like, I've enjoyed the Demiguise as a creature for many years, years and years and years ago, before the Fantastic Beasts films were even an idea. I was in an online, it was basically like a Hogwarts house that people put together fictitious classes and everything that was called Hogwarts Online. And part of that was a set of tests that you had to take that would determine like what your values were. And they used all these weird traits that they took out of the Fantastic Beasts book that had been released. And we're like, okay, so different wand cores that aren't just the same four things. And the first wand core that I got, it was a 12 1/4 inch willow wand, which was bendy and had a demiguy's hair core. So I started looking into that, and it just became a creature that I greatly enjoyed. So seeing them in the films made me very happy.
Yes. And Dougal is just the best, so.
Yeah, he really was also Dougal. The best.
And last question, what is your favorite character from the Fantastic Beasts series? You can say Dumbledore, it's fine, if Dumbledore is your favorite.
No.
But.
Okay, yeah, we'll have to talk about Dumbledore another day.
Oh, no.
Is
there a binder for that?
Oh, yes. I wrote papers about that at university for my philosophy degree. We'll talk later. But personally, my favorite character in the Fantastic Beasts franchise is Newt, to be very honest.
Nice.
He has a lot of empathy. He has a lot of compassion. He, despite being faced with difficult circumstances, continues to try to do what's right, even when it's hard and frustrating and heartbreaking. And that's inspiring to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we are so happy to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Speaking of people we are also happy to have in our lives, we are going to give a shout out to this week's Speak Beastie Patreon supporter, Roger B. Thank you so much for your support. Couldn't do it without you.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you, Roger. Yeah.
I think that's my least painful segue.
Yeah, good job.
That seemed to be like the most natural.
Yeah,
right.
Sometimes they're a little bit forced.
Oh, they're painful sometimes. Okay.
And the worst is when you are not in the episode and we have to do that.
Oh,
that's gosh.
We're just kind of like, here it is.
We try.
No segue.
Just jump in.
So I guess it's time for our Phoenix Register.
And now a message from our sponsors. Hey you! Yes, you! The magical cats and dolls waving your wands like bean shooters in a caper. Looking to be on the up and up about Newt Scamander, famous zoologist and world traveler? No need for gossip at the juice joint. Just tune your ears to Speak Beastie. And now, for as little as $1 a month, you can make Speak Beastie the Neasles Meow. Support the show at patreon.com, and suddenly you're the big cheese, the real McCoy, with exclusive access to swell sneak peeks, bloopers, and behind-the-scenes features. But wait, there's more! Sponsors can also beat their gums at the joint with access to the Speak Beastie Common Room on Facebook. Now you're really on the clean sweep, flyboy. Get a wiggle on to patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more about becoming a sponsor today. It's the Billy Wigs Knees and How.
I don't think we did any Phoenix Register for our panel at LeakyCon. So even if we have a full month to cover about what news we missed, and I still struggle to find news, but the most important news is, and you guessed it with our last episode, but LeakyCon Chicago was great. We loved it, and we are so, so glad to have met so many cool people like Dag, and the fact that you are here now, it feels like LeakyCon is not totally over. We continue the cool discussion that we started, so that's super cool. And we saw quite a few Fantastic Beasts cosplays, so that was really, really cool to see Niflers and Newts and Tinas and we saw some Queenies, I think.
Queenie, and there's Lita too.
Yeah, Lita, yeah, Lita. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I saw Grindelwald somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a whole family.
Yes.
Like, the dad was Grindelwald, and like the kids were Bella and Lucius. It was adorable.
Yeah.
That's who I was thinking about. I forgot they were a set.
So Fantastic Beasts was also present in some discussion in the panels, but not a lot. We got ours, of course, but also Laurie's panel about Nagini that was awesome. So yeah, I want to mention that. So we are glad that some people, some cool kids, are still here to continue the Fantastic Beasts discussion.
And we just have to keep you keep like just doing it anyway. I've gotten to the point that like next year is gonna be like, okay, cool, I finished my panel. Oh, I have a spare 10 minutes. I'm gonna go stand outside the panel and just keep talking to people and get them excited yes. about it again. Just keep going.
Yeah. So yeah, that was really cool, and I guess we will still have things to talk about in the following weeks, I guess. Maybe on Patreon, we'll see, but in things to show you. But yeah, it was great. But now it's time to back to Hogwarts, because when this episode will be released, it will be time to go back to school. So I hope you didn't miss the Hogwarts Express, guys. But so yeah, so usually we don't know what they will announce during this event, because this year they Warner Bros. Planned several official events throughout the world. I know we will have one in Paris. There will be one in London. I guess one in the US. I don't remember where. But so yeah, we will have some events. So maybe some announcement during these events. I don't know. I don't want to put our hopes too high from any Fantastic Beasts announcement because we don't have any clues for that. But they announced that we will have a sneak peek for the Mysterious Visions of Magic that I mentioned few episodes ago. That will be an event touring across the world. We still don't know where it will start, but maybe that will be some of the news that will be announced. But yeah, we will see some images and some sneak peek, like they say. And we know in this event, we will have an immersive news case experience. So I hope, I'm still very excited about that and to see how it will look like. So yeah, I hope we will have that in a sneak peek. But we don't know yet. You know when you will listen to that.
Yeah, you'll know more than us.
Whatever happened to that Harry Potter festival that Warner Brothers was hyping up last
year?
I know.
Like,
it just disappeared.
That just fizzled out, didn't it?
It just disappeared.
Yeah, it was supposed to be this year, but we are going more and more close to the end of the year, so I guess it's too late now.
Maybe that'll be the announcement.
Maybe
it's today.
Maybe they're trying to like push the launch of that event back to coincide with like announcements for the HBO stuff or yeah. Max.
Oh, so maybe they're trying to wait out the strike.
Oh, maybe, yeah, that too.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah. So yeah, no news about that. We will see. But something else cool just happened. If you are listening to us from South Korea, Minalima just opened a new pop store in Seoul yesterday when we released this episode on September 2nd. And I thought about including this news because our friend Lori just was in South Korea. So I was yeah. like, maybe we have other listeners there. And from what I saw on the article announcing that, it looks exactly like the flagship store in London. So you will be able to find all the amazing Fantastic Beasts design that Minalima did for the movies. So yeah, if you're there and you can visit it, send us pictures, because it's always the Minalima stores are always just the best place. So yeah.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
No, Lori's trip and that the little cafe that she went to that had all the books and everything, it was like Harry Potter themed, that had a copy of her book there. Fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool.
What a dream, honestly, right?
Yeah, it's great. I'm a big fan of Lori.
She's awesome.
We are too.
Like, I already, like, was obsessed with her, and then like I met her and I was like, and she's so nice and pretty and she gives good hugs. Oh my yeah. god, what am I gonna do with myself?
No, she's fantastic. Absolutely, she's fantastic.
And just met all the cool kids at Leaky.
I really
Leaky
did
is where all the cool kids hang out.
And yeah. like again, I in my heart, I'm despite the fact that I am legitimately a grown woman with like a job and a mortgage and stuff, part of me is still like an insecure 16-year-old who like can't go up to the cool kids because they'll make fun of me.
Yeah, that's so. Pretty much where I'm at. I mean, yeah, I'm 31 with a job, and you know, I have my own place and all that, and I'm like, I can't approach them first. They're gonna think I'm weird because I like this thing that they did. Me trying to approach Lori to sign my book, like. Yeah, no. We all have cool kid syndrome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I hear some owls approaching.
Oh, here they come.
Yay. They're here. Yay. There was no owl post at LeakyCon, obviously.
We did not have time.
So we are answering or reading off answers to the episode 183 question, which was, what unanswered questions do you have from the Fantastic Beasts series? So on Instagram, the username Miss Alphaba Kayenta says, I want to know if Credence is going to die. Yeah. We don't really know.
We don't really
how
know
that's gonna go. I would assume.
I don't know. I feel like anybody after walking out down all those stairs is pretty questionable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Honestly, it's the walking cardio down the stairs, I would probably just feel like I'd just fall.
Right.
But like my first thought when it came to how they were portraying Credence is everything is they used so much Phoenix imagery that. Mm-hmm. I don't think he would. I think he probably wouldn't be the Credence we knew anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to go through a big change of some kind.
So here's a question then. If we do get a fourth movie, are they recasting Ezra Miller?
Hope
and
so.
Then the thing is like, oh, Credence died and was reborn, and now he's somebody else.
They could have, you know, Yeah, they could have done that in between the first and second film, too. Like, they had, like, this perfect segue with, here's a piece of mist. He doesn't have a body anymore. It would have been very easy to do. And considering that we just didn't get any explanation for Mads as Grindelwald now, like, they would do it. Like, we know they would. But will they is the question.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't think Credence would ever make it to movie four. I think he's a goner. And I think they did that on purpose so they wouldn't have to bother with the recast.
I mean, we still don't know if they would bother with movie four, so.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
They are! They are! Let me have it.
Yeah, okay. We'll feed to your delusion. It's fine.
Quietly weeps.
Yeah.
But we if you listened to last episode, we know how to make Credence survive. So, yeah.
Yeah, we do know
we
how
have
to make
a whole
Credence
theory
survive
about that. So
that's true.
Problem solved. and we have another bit of owl post from Carolyn, our graphic designer. And Carolyn says, so many questions and so little time. I want to know what Queenie was doing during the events of the last film. I am sure it was important, but I still want to know.
I think she meant to say Tina, because we know what Queenie was doing.
So. Queenie was mostly just moping around the castle.
Do we know what Queenie was doing?
Yeah, that was what I was about to say. Like, we get Queenie so little, and we get these little glimpses, but we don't really know what her responsibilities are outside of
That's
confirming
true.
For Grindelwald whatever he already assumes is the truth.
Right.
Like, outside of that, we don't know.
I was assuming that was her main job to stay with Grindelwald, and Grindelwald could ask her randomly, like, is he telling the truth or not? Is she telling the truth? So I think that was
that's her
main
only
job.
That's kind of sad. I'd be very bored.
And I think we talked about this before, but like, at what point did Queenie decide I made a really bad mistake in coming here? I feel like we got none of that.
No.
We really didn't get
insight. I feel like it was, like, minutes.
Yeah, she really went, like, hard heel turn, hard face turn, and we didn't really get any build-up to either of those turns.
I feel like the first time she really... Because I don't know if she's ever really gotten a true look into Grindelwald's mind, or if he was just using what is kind of, obviously, some kind of, you know... magical adaptation of his already there charisma to convince people. But like, I think the first time she got an actual look in his brain and saw the things that he had done, like, you know, the killing of the baby for no reason. Like, there are lots of things like, oh, no, he just said lots of pretty things. He didn't mean them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I already mentioned that in an episode, but I think her turn in the rally was because she was surrounded by so many supporters and listening to their thoughts. It was overwhelming for her. Absolutely. So, yeah.
Oh, so many unanswered questions.
But if Caroline was thinking about what Tina was doing, because I'm assuming that was she was, but maybe I'm just maybe that's really Queenie that she was meant to ask, but we still need to know what Tina was doing.
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
They say that she had important things to do as the head of the our office in Makuza, but we don't know what was.
But what?
Yeah, but like, what does that look like? What is she doing?
Yeah.
That would be a cool idea for a Max series to have something about, a mini series about what Tina on missions doing all the other things that was happening in movie 3, what all the little missions that she had to do in the US, I guess, with other Grindelwald followers. I don't know, but yeah, I'm guessing that that could be something interesting.
Yeah.
That would be cool.
That would be cool. I'd watch that. Like, if it was a spinoff that was just about what was happening, not the main characters, not the main people we have to watch the whole time, what happened in between those moments, but what our supportive side characters are doing that is just as important. Yeah. And the kind of, like, what leads up to all those big moments. I think that would be cool.
Like, can we get the planning sessions where Vinda's like, so I'm going to set fire to this banner.
Yeah.
I'm going to wear this hat and look fabulous while I do it.
I'm
going to
look extremely fierce while I do this.
I really need to conduct fiend fire for like 20 minutes. I promise it'll be very intimidating.
It's going to be really cool. You guys just have to trust me.
Yes, it'll work.
Would watch that HBO Max.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's it for our Owl Post. As always, we love to hear from you. So send us your thoughts. We'll give that email at the end of the episode. But you can also leave comments on all of our social media. We love to read them.
This leads us into our main discussion. So as mentioned at the top of the show, when I cornered Dag in the marketplace, instead of running away.
Nope.
As
why would I run?
Someone else might have. They were said like, hello, let me show you my research.
Do you know how often I get to show off my research? There are very few corners where this is an acceptable thing to do.
So we have asked Dag on today to discuss Obscurials and then their theory about Obscurials and Patronuses being kind of two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, that was, yeah, I tried to get some traction on Tumblr way back when with it. No one bit the bait. So I was like, well, I guess I'll just bring this to LeakyCon crowds. Eventually someone will listen to me. And here we are.
Now is your time to
now
shine.
Now is my time. So, hello. All
right, take it away. Wherever you want to start.
Yeah. So I'm going to start probably with just like the basics of Obscurus and Obscurials. So the Obscurus is the actual like manifestation of magic. We know that the Obscurus is not a magical creature. It's not like a Dementor or a Lethifold, even though it both kills people and likes negative emotions. It's not a beast. There aren't wild Obscuruses in wherever you want to think they are. Space, I
Thank
don't
God.
Know. But, but
are we sure that black holes are not obscurus? Because I'm not sure.
Oh my god! Yeah, you know what? Are they alien obscuruses?
Yeah, the universe is obscuruses.
All the obscurus after they wizard dies, they all go to space
they
and form
the
big
black holes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know what? Antimatter. Yeah. So the obscurus, from what we understand, is formed when somebody with magic intensely represses their magic and their abilities for a prolonged period of time. It's not like hide and seek for a little while. It is for ages and ages and ages and ages. The person who hosts the Obscurus is called the Obscurial, and 90% of the time, from what we are shown, has an intense trauma or intense fear driving the repression of their magic. And that makes me think that fear is absolutely essential for an Obscurus to form. In the course of the films, we're told that Obscurus were more common before the segregation of the magical and non-magical communities with the International Statute of Secrecy, that magical people would fear the repercussions or, you know, the attacks that could happen from people who were afraid and did not understand and did not have magic, who would cause harm to them in, you know, retaliation for whatever their other abilities would be. In universe, according to the Makuza person, the Obscurus and Obscurial hasn't existed in centuries, which is a load of shit. Not just because of Credence and the Sudanese girl that Newt encounters off screen, but with Ariana Dumbledore. And I don't know about you, but the first thing I'm going to think of when a cop says something doesn't exist is, of course it does. They just stop telling you. Like, sorry. They're just not telling you anymore. Especially because the fear then changes from what the non-magical community is going to do to what the magical community does in retaliation for the destruction. Like, there's a whole nother set of debates there about why they don't believe that they exist anymore. And it isn't all happy-go-lucky. Yeah.
And it's also, like, the Wizarding Society is so deep... organized around the Statute of Secrecy, that the fact that they don't want to admit that the Statute of Secrecy make them... they didn't make them safe from everything, it wasn't the big solution for everything for their society. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Obscurus still exists, it's kind of admitting that the Statute of Secrecy is not perfect.
Yeah, so. That it didn't fix the problem. Like, we did this because look at all these awful things that were happening, and the Statute of Secrecy didn't actually solve those problems because here these still are. And yeah, the Wizarding World is very much like stringent in their society and their beliefs based upon a very limited scope of experience, considering how long their history should be, if the Statute of Secrecy only went into effect in the late 1600s. But that's a whole different thing. As far as we are shown, Obscurus are inherently destructive, and they seem to be parasitic since the children at the end of being an Obscurial die. And there is no record in universe of an Obscurial, the host for the Obscurus, surviving past 10 years old, which... I'll talk about that later, actually, because I have it in the rest of the sets of things. But it's very interesting to me that Obscurus form when accidental magic is at its most intense from what we are shown in universe in young childhood. And they don't have control, as we learn later. But yeah, those are the basics of Obscurus that we all know where we're coming from, basically, because now I'm going to jump to the exact opposite end of the spectrum, in my opinion, and go back to the Patronus charm. We're shown over and over and over again that big magic is difficult, and that the Patronus charm is an incredibly big and apparently mysterious form of magic. The Patronus charm's incantation literally translates to "I summon a protector." And I think that is interesting because the way that it protects is by just kind of pushing away the problem. It just is like, we'll take this problem and we'll push it somewhere else. Like, that's it. It doesn't get rid of it. It just kind of gets it out of view.
That's how I deal with every problem in my life.
I was going to say, like, if dementors really are a metaphor for depression, then Patronuses are really kind of like that girly who's like, have you just tried yoga?
Exactly. You just need to drink more water. You'll be fine. But yeah, so the Patronus charm is supposed to be a projection of all of your most positive feelings. And in order to produce a fully corporeal Patronus, it has to be, like, super intense. Not just any happy little thought a la, you know, Peter Pan is going to do. There's the incorporeal Patronus, that shield that Lupin makes, that is both the beginning of the Patronus charm, and supposedly what most people are able to cast would be that kind of shield, or the way to obscure what your Patronus is. So if someone has enough magical control to just make the shield, which I believe is the case in regards to Lupin. That's just me personally, though. But to make a full Patronus, you need a super happy memory, or apparently a strong enough fantasy based on Harry's OWL Patronus being conjured by imagining Umbridge getting fired. And you have to have the inherent confidence that you can do it. You can't, you know, Hermione doesn't produce her own Patronus until she stops doubting herself. When she doubts herself, she cannot produce her Patronus. Same thing happens with Harry. Harry just gets the shield over and over again until he's already seen himself in the past do it. He's like, oh, I can do that. And then he does it. It's a very cyclical way of thinking, but until you are sure that you have something that is strong enough, it just doesn't function. And it is also said that the Patronus can change its shape based on big emotional upheaval. Falling intensely in love is the main example we have. I would also posit probably intense trauma would also change it, because it seems, based on an interview from JK back in the times that I still thought of what she said outside of the direct text as canon, which is interviews before 2009, she was asked about James and Lily's Patronuses, that they were a set, like, oh, were they always that way? And she replied that the Patronus will often mutate to take the image of the love of one's life. That they often become, that love of one's life becomes like the subject of the memories that fuel the Patronus. So to me, that definitely tells me that the thoughts and memories that you use to fuel a Patronus will alter its shape if they are directly enough tied to you, if that makes sense. Now, the technicalities of it, just for the sake of this, the Patronus is only really active when the caster is focusing on it. Like, they have to call it into being, they have to give it directions, and they have to hold that magic until its task has been completed, or the Patronus dissipates, based on the memories that we have from The Prince's Tale, showing Snape with the Patronus leading Harry to the sword, and all of those kind of things. If the Patronus isn't, like, actively facing a Dementor, or supposedly a Lethifold, even though we're not shown that, but it's talked about, it seems to take on some traits of the animals that they resemble, like, you know, otters and rabbits, you know, swimming around or jumping around, and the way that Harry's Patronus approaches him and bows its head, all that kind of thing. Yeah. We're told that this is an incredibly difficult form of magic, both, like, directly, when Lupin talks about it, when he's starting to teach Harry, when Amelia Bones is super impressed at the trial, being like, oh, you weren't lying about it. That's very impressive. When the Professor Tofty at Harry's OWLs is, like, super admiring of Harry's ability to produce it during his tests, and also in the absolutely disbelieving reactions of Fudge and Umbridge. But we are also shown that there are lots of characters who can cast the Patronus if they don't doubt themselves, in the form of the DA. They're able to, under the instruction of another 15-year-old, just magically be able to do this magic that apparently most witches and wizards aren't able to master in their lifetimes.
Yeah, because it's a 15-year-old that is about able to do it, that make the other 15-year-old like, oh, if he can do it, we can too.
Yeah.
Like, it's easy. It's easier to be confident when you see people that are the same age and the same abilities like you to.
Exactly.
He was the perfect professor to teach that, I guess.
Harry was absolutely the perfect professor to teach that, especially because of how he figured out that he could do it by seeing himself do it, was how it happened. And the rest of the students seeing him, like, even the pure-blooded students in the class, once they took him seriously, seeing that he could do it, were like, okay, well, maybe the things that I've been told my whole life are wrong. Maybe I can do this. And then they proceeded to do it, which, you know, is that part of J.K. Rowling forgetting how tough she made the Patronus charm sound? Or is it just trying to show that Harry surrounds himself with powerful people, or just how powerful young magic is? Who knows? But if we put all these little details about the Patronus charm together, then the Patronus itself is absolutely unique to their caster. It is definitely more powerful when it is fully formed. It's only really able to do things when it's been told and actively, conssciously told to do things. It has to be told to or actively directed to lead someone somewhere or to send a message, a la Shacklebolt sending the message at Fleur's wedding. It is definitely a passive protector, so it just kind of either stands there and, you know, shoos things away or runs them off. It doesn't conquer them or, you know, destroy them at all. It's obviously made of light, and it's a projection of the most positive feelings that a caster can have. On the exact opposite end of that spectrum, we'll jump back to the Obscurus. The Obscurus is supposedly just a dark force that develops and grows inside of a magical being who has to hide their abilities.
Hmm.
Most examples that we have of Obscurus and Obscurials are children who have severe trauma tied to them, and that causes those traumas, those memories, or the ideas of things that could happen to them based on stories or experiences, cause them to very much attempt and succeed to become an Obscurus in absolutely suppressing their magic in every conscious facet of their being. This kind of manifestation of magic, to me, seems to be the most violent outburst of accidental magic there can be. It operates entirely on subconscious intent, and it seems to be completely tied to that person. Like, the Obscurus doesn't, you know, go off and, I don't know, possess somebody else. The Obscurus is, you know, what it does, whatever it's going to do, it goes right back to that person, and that's just where it hangs out.
Yeah, it reminds me that we tried so hard to connect Credence and Ariana with thinking that the Obscurus might have, the connection between Credence and the Dumbledore would be through his Obscurus that could be the same as Ariana, but that doesn't make sense. It's Credence has his own Obscurus because that's something very personal.
He's got his own trauma.
Yeah, and that's always was because even if I liked this theory, I was like, Credence doesn't need to have an Obscurus from Ariana. He has enough trauma to have his own.
Yeah, it's not like his life was all sunshine and strawberries before Ariana's Obscurus show up.
Yeah, exactly. We've got that. It's also like in regards to Credence, if we're taking his lineage into account, as you know, we must. It makes me wonder if the Dumbledore line has a predilection for Obscurus, because that would be two in the same line that we know of.
Right.
That's true, but
that's such like a parallel to a lot of things. Like,
yeah, there's a lot of layers.
Yeah.
Like, you kind of wonder, would Credence still have had that tendency? Would it still have happened if he had been raised by his biological mother?
The kind of question I have is, would he have lasted as long as he did?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think it would be very easy for him to still have had an Obscurus if he had not been a Dumbledore and he was just some, you know, random magic user that we just happened to be following. But I don't know if his Obscurus would have kept him alive that long if he didn't have the powerful bloodline, since that seems to be the main focal point of like, oh yeah, well, maybe he's a Lestrange, maybe he's this, that it's like, okay, the bloodline is very important.
Mm.
Yeah. There's been some discussion in circles that I've been in that people are like, well, what if the Obscurus is like an accidental Horcrux? That it just separates the soul from the being, like a portion of the soul and the magic, but that without a container it can't exist very long. Based on what we've seen of Horcruxes and the kind of compulsion that Kowalski had to kind of interact with the, you know, the Obscurus that's being contained in Newt's, that was being contained in Newt's case, that he was like very drawn to it. We only see that kind of thing displayed in regards to like the diadem or the ring
for Voldemort's Horcruxes. I do think that the magic and the soul are very entwined, which is also part of where this Obscurus Patronus theory comes from, in that you can't have one without the other in a world of magic users.
Wow. I never thought of this connection between Horcrux and Obscurus, but yeah, that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Huh.
Yeah, I never made that connection about, like, the compulsion, about how the portion of the soul needs to be inside of something.
Yeah, like, it wants to be somewhere, so it was exposed, and so it was like, oh, look, here is an easy target. Right? Because also the Horcrux, like, the purpose of the Horcrux is to possess the being to mm-hmm. be able to put their soul in there. So it's like, oh, cool, easy target. I can go somewhere and I can have a new home. But yeah, so that was just a side note question that somebody threw at me once.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never thought of that either.
In The Crimes of Grindelwald, Dumbledore says that Obscurus grow in the absence of love as a dark twin and an only friend. Which, after confirming Ariana's Obscurial, makes me pretty mad at him for his dismissiveness yeah. of Aberforth's care for Ariana. Like, she had right? no friends. Who's he?
And about all of his family, because, I mean, Ariana was an Obscurus in their mother's care, so... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's... like, okay, the mother, she doesn't count. Like, I just, yeah, that statement just made me, that rubbed me a bit wrong.
Albus himself, but, what, he didn't love her at all?
Yeah, well, you know, he was so focused on Grindelwald at the time. You know, all of those 8 years between Ariana's attack and her death, he didn't care about her at all. He didn't,
I mean,
that
that's,
doesn't count.
That's part, I can see that that's part of his guilt, thinking maybe I didn't love her enough, so that I'm one of the reason why she developed an Obscurus. But he's not alone. He has a brother and a mother.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's not just him. Like, he can't take that all himself either. Like, we all know guilt is one of Albus Dumbledore's, like, many middle names, but it doesn't it doesn't mean that it's true. You know, he can try to take on all the guilt he wants. But that does make me think that without Aberforth and without Kendra, the Obscurus would have consumed her sooner.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Hmm.
Oh, definitely. Because she was 14?
She was just around 14 when the confrontation happens.
And that's not the Obscurus that killed her. That's a
right.
Spell.
So she could have lived
that's also, isn't that part of, like, their... figuring it out is whether it was actually the spell or not, because we're not told what Ariana looked like after her death, and we don't know if the Obscurus, when and if they killed their Obscurial, we're not told if they have those same distinctive scarring marks that all of the victims of the Obscurus have had that we've seen on screen. We don't know for sure in that regard, if they leave behind a body at all. And if we think about how the Obscurus handled, Credence's having the killing curse shot at him in the third film, or the whole duel at the end of the first, like, the Obscurus is obviously able to just be like, well, I don't care what that was. And it just kind of ignores the magic that's been shot at it for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Now, something that I focus on that most people just kind of, you know, when I've discussed this, they're like, oh, I forgot they said that. In the very beginning of the first Fantastic Beasts film, there's a throwaway comment from one of the witnesses says that it was like a wind with shining white eyes. And we're never shown shining white eyes when we're looking at the Obscurus. We see the wind. We briefly get Credence's face. We see the wind again. We get this, like, you know, the big dark mist and all that it makes. But we don't get those shining white eyes at all, which makes me think about, you know, if we're thinking about the Obscurus and the Patronus as being expressions of the soul, that the darkness is what's obviously kind of, like, encompassing the soul at that point. They're being consumed by their trauma and their rage and their fear, but there is still hope inside. There's still light deep within. It's just obscured from view. But,
but it still has this kind of it's this mass of darkness, but like I don't know how to explain it, but like it has a fire inside, like it's a fiery darkness. I don't know how to.
Yeah, well, there's passion there. It isn't that it's not hopelessness. I don't feel like any magical being who had no hope or drive would become an obscurist. They're trying to hide, but if they were hiding out of hopelessness, I think they would just wither and die.
It's anger. Kind of, it's like,
It's the anger. Yeah, it's that rage. It's the injustice of it. Right? We don't have any records of obscurus and obscurial surviving past the age of 10, but again, you don't tell cops stuff. And, you know, the Dumbledores are the easiest example for having hidden Ariana just away until she was 14. Now, I did have the thought that she didn't start trying to repress her magic at all until she was 6, which means that her obscurus was only 8, which fits that 10-year gap. So I think we also need to think about at what point they start actively repressing magic as being part of, like, that age range for obscurus.
That's true.
I guess a baby couldn't start to repress its magic. It's later in life when you are conscious about that.
It's once you know. You're like, oh, right, that's me. Which is, that's why Harry never becomes one, because he has no idea that any of that is tied to him.
Yeah.
It's like, once the kid's like, oh, it's something I did, that they start repressing it.
I guess you have to be three or four, at least. Yeah, you really couldn't get that
until, toddlerhood.
Yeah. I want to know at what point Credence became aware that he had magic.
Yeah.
Like, did he even, like, have a name for what it was that he was doing at that point in time? Like, how did he know that he was?
I think that's also, I don't know if he absolutely knew he did. I don't think he ever for sure knew he did. I think he knew he had something. I think he may have thought he could, you know, if I wish really hard, the things that I want happen. Because, you know, it's anytime that we see that obscurus moving in the first film, anytime that we see, like, the repercussions of its actions, it's literally, with the exception of, I think, once or twice, in direct response to something happening to Credence or somebody in his family. Like, the whole time. Like, the senator at the newspaper, he's focuses on him, and then he dies, right? He's thrown into his own poster. It's like, oh, yeah, well, here you are. And then he gets destroyed. This is after he called Credence and his family freaks at the newspaper. Like, it's like, here this happens, and Credence was obviously mad about it, and he probably wished in his head really hard, like, man, I wish something awful would happen to you. And then, oh my goodness, it happened. So he probably just thought that he had something, and he knew about magic, so he probably knew it was something, but I don't think he knew he had control over it, or that he knew he would... You know, I think that's also part of why he wanted Grindelgraves' attention, right? He's like, oh, you told me you would teach me to tie those things together, you know?
Yeah.
And it's also interesting to me that the Obscurus itself doesn't choose targets unless there's a lack of connection there. Like, we obviously know that Mary Lou beats the shit out of Credence regularly. He doesn't question her when she asks for his belt. He just kind of resigned and sitting there. He doesn't try to fight back or anything like that. But it isn't until Mary Lou says that she's not his mother. She has no connection to him. She insults his birth family, whoever they are that he doesn't know, that the Obscurus is like, well, I guess that's done. It's when Credence stops thinking about her even as being part of his family or part of the things that he cares about. Right? And then that's when that happens. And then it's not until Grindelgraves is like, you're a squib, I could smell it on you, and he goes on his whole tirade, that Credence is like, okay, well, I guess I'm done then. And gives up control entirely. It's not until then that Grindelgraves is considered a threat. Right? It's not until then. But it's also interesting that the things that in that big battle and everything else, the things that actually seem to almost draw the battle back to an almost stop is when Tina and Newt are able to show compassion and show understanding and give space to Credence, that he starts to kind of come back to awareness of himself, kind of in the same ways that, you know, people who are traumatized need to know and have people that they can rely on and turn to. Now, obviously, those things are promptly shot out of the water by Madame Pickery and Grindelgraves, because they only know how to eliminate or appeal to the inherent power and darkness of the things that are coming after them, right? Like, that's all they know. They don't see anything about the person anymore. They see this as just, this is an awful darkness, an awful being. They are immediately dismissing any humanity that Credence had and attack it solely as a magical thing, despite it not being that way and there being layers to it.
Yeah, it connects to what we said earlier, the fact that they said that, yeah, no, Obscurus is not a thing in centuries. And the when we see the how they react to one, that makes sense that it's a lie. It's something that they have to say that, and they have to, but at the same time, they have to say it doesn't exist, but it has to exist when you see how they react to it. Like, I don't know. I think the two are connected. The how we see the power reacting to Credence.
Yeah. Oh, that's, you know, like when earlier I was like, yeah, just because they're not afraid of the non-magical beings attacking them anymore doesn't mean there isn't fear from the magical community that would make them still occur and still happen, because we all know they're a prejudiced lot, very stuck in their ways. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many layers of ways that they can and do hurt each other. And it's interesting that once, after the first film, the next time we see the Obscurus as the Obscurus, so when we actually see the dark mist wind, we only really see it when Grimson tries to kill Credence with the killing curse after when he's talking to Irma, right? Mm-hmm. That it's, and it's thoughtless. It was not something like he couldn't have known this killing curse was coming at him. He had no idea, but the Obscurus itself still protected him by discorporating him and then bringing him back to that moment. It was the only moment that was utilized was to save Credence's life. So it's interesting.
That goes back to the comment about the Obscurus being like the friend to a friendless child.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, like an only friend, you know? Yeah. It's like, yeah, of course I'll protect you, you know?
It's like if your imaginary friend actually comes and rescues you from a burning building.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. If your imaginary friend's like, okay, I got this. And who's going to believe you, right? That your imaginary friend came and saved you. But, you know, that's what happened, right?
And if that's the case, that makes you less inclined to want to get rid of said entity. Yep. Because it's now, like, considered positive to you when really it's killing you from the inside out.
Yeah, and especially in Credence's case, we don't know how much of that last battle he actively remembers. And how much of that period from between the end of the battle and when we see him next he recalls or is in control of. He definitely remembers parts of it when he was, you know, at the forefront of his consciousness. But the likelihood that he remembers the whole circumstances is very slim, going by how he reacts to Grindelwald later on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. It looks like he came back to the start of his relationship with Grindelgraves, this twisted thing between the two of them. We see that again in movie 3 and at the end of movie 2. But it's like, yeah, he forgot that Grindelwald insulted him and attacked him. Like, it's
and how much of that is going to be like, is that repressed memory that will be coming back later? Is that part of what is causing this dichotomy between him at the end of the third film? Like, there are a lot of questions there.
Does Credence ever know that Graves is Grindelwald?
That's what I'm wondering, because the mist was there when they did the big reveal. That's why it's like, how much does he really remember? And how much does Grindelwald tell him? What does he use in his advantage?
Even if he knows, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but knowing how he was beaten by Mary Lou during all of his life before that could also be a weird thing like he, I mean, he might still go to Grindelwald even if he remembered that he was attacking. Mean, yeah.
Yeah, because as far as he knows, that is how adults who care for you show
exactly
their affection. That they insult you, they abuse you, and that but they still take care of you.
Yeah, well, exactly. So and how much does
I know?
Well, especially considering like we don't know how because when we're talking about why Tina got demoted in the first place, right? They talk about her issue with the bare bones, and we know that they got obliviated, and we don't know how the Obscurus interferes with that, if he remembers any of what Tina did prior to that, or if he just thinks these random people showed up in the midst of my temper tantrum and they were really nice. Like, if he remembers any of it at all, like, they're the exception to the rule either way, based on the way the rest of his society and all of his experience has taught him.
Yeah, it gives Nagini a very important and tragic role too, because she was the one who could change the what he was used to and what he was.
Yes.
So yeah, and that's so sad that it didn't work at the end.
Yeah, well, it didn't work, and then like she just disappeared.
And she was like, bye. Gone.
It just stops. It's like, well, that didn't work. I guess I'm done. And she just walked off into the wilderness to go become a snake. And
I was, if we go by Jeff's theory, she was like, okay, well, I'm going to go have Snape's mom now. Bye.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a whole other can of worms. But yeah. So the Obscurus reacts to negative stimulus, and it looks like once that stimulus kind of reaches a breaking point, a la when Grindelgrace pushes Credence to his breaking point, and he's like, well, I don't think I'm going to do that anymore. It hit me very much like when Harry loses his temper in Dumbledore's office after Sirius's death. He just starts taking it out on everything. But, you know, eventual, you know, understanding and those kind of things are what kind of temper it back down. So to pull it kind of together, if the Obscurus is dependent on its host and unique to them, it's directed by subconscious or instinctive intent. It's a dark mist. It is a very destructive force. The Obscurus is like, I will go and destroy that problem for you. You will never see it again. You will know that you will not have to face that again. It's fueled by an absence of love, the presence of fear and trauma. It can be formed through trauma, and it leaves these very distinct scars based on its attack. Whereas the Patronus is, you know, it's unique to the caster. It's more powerful when it has full form, whereas the Obscurus seems to be more powerful the less formed it is. The Patronus has to be actively cast. It just kind of pushes things away, and it's made of light for the most immediate dichotomy here. And it's a projection of the most positive feelings, the three defining characteristics, in my opinion, as powerful magic, that they are protective forces, they're unique to the caster, and are powered by strong emotion, which we're told time and again, even for the Unforgivables, is essential for powerful magic. It means to me that they are very obviously being made to be the opposites of each other. If the Patronus is meant to symbolize the healing strength of joy and contentedness, then the Obscurus is meant to symbolize the strength of anger and fear in a soul that's been scarred. To take this to what I believe is the logical conclusion, that means that the magic that kind of holds the Obscurus in Newt's case is also Patronus magic, because we don't see that kind of containment being used for much beyond that. And it looks like the same kind of silvery, wispy magic that's associated with memory and with Patronuses, which is either, you know, again, one of those instances where the caster is choosing not to have a form. So instead of Newt having whatever his active Patronus is, just kind of patrolling an area, he literally has the Obscurus contained entirely within itself. Now, he does say that the child still died, which also makes me think that the separation of magic and, you know, magic and soul fully from the child, like the separation, like, okay, he was able to get the Obscurus out and contain it, but we don't know if that child left a body behind or not. So we don't know if she's still in there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. She's gone now, but you know, that Newt not able to do anything about it. If there was a body, then Newt's just kind of kept this magic in a stasis bubble made of positive memories.
And
I can't think of another way for that to work.
And it made me think about the Deluminator, Albus's Deluminator, because that's what he used in the scene in movie 3 in the mirror world.
Yeah,
and that's the only time what we see the Obscurus detach. It's still connected to Credence, but it's kind of pushed away from Credence, and that's with the Deluminator. So that makes me think about the magic behind this object that Dumbledore created. Maybe it's a magic connected to the Patronus, like it's the same kind of light, and it makes sense with the what it's used for. It can bring light in darkness, and it can also the fact that it's used like Ron positive feeling toward his friend to bring back him to his friend. It's like also the same type of, I don't know, positive mysterious magic that is behind Patronus. So.
Yeah. Well, aren't we told at some point that love is one of the most mysterious magics that there is in the Department of Mysteries, and that they like focus on it all the time? But also, if we're thinking about the Deluminator and Dumbledore specifically, if I'm not entirely incorrect, I believe somewhere it was mentioned that Dumbledore is the one who figured out that you could use the Patronuses to send messages, which means that he experiments with Patronus magic already.
Ah, yes. Hmm.
So, like, it would make sense. It would also be, in my opinion, a kind of funny parallel to, like, the opposite of a Horcrux.
Right.
Yeah. Huh.
Cool.
You put a couple happy memories in a thing.
Yeah.
Huh.
I imagining Dumbledore dealing with his grief and trauma, just experiencing with Patronus, and like, that's my way to heal.
What was it? Yeah, there's, I believe at some point it's like, yeah, you know, you can summon your Patronus like at any time. I don't know if Dumbledore did it or not, but can you imagine just somebody who's like, okay, I'm going to deal with this now. Talk to myself, but I needed a target, so I summoned my Patronus so I could talk at myself.
you are right. It was invented by Dumbledore. That's insane.
I was like, I'm pretty sure that happened, but you know, I don't have my notes in front of me, so.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Harry Potter lexicon, and it says it was invented by Albus Dumbledore as a way for members of the Order of the Phoenix to send messages to each other. Because only Order members knew how to cast this magic, which sounds fake, but okay.
Yeah, that sounds fake.
The recipients would be assured that the message was genuine.
Yeah, well, it's also like, the recipient could be assured that the message was genuine because you can't fake your Patronus shape.
Right. Right, you can't. And presumably you can't cast a Patronus under duress, or if you're Imperioed, because if you're Imperioed, you are not genuinely summoning those positive
emotions.
Yeah,
they're not your memories, right? Like, it's...
Yeah.
But also, like, I think it also brings into question, like, what, like, the actual, like, content of what makes a memory happy, because, like, Umbridge can cast a Patronus, which is freaking dumb, but she can cast a Patronus... What's she thinking about? Probably awful
torturing students.
She's thinking about kicking children in the head.
Yeah.
But that makes her happy, so it works.
Yeah, exactly. It makes her happy, so it's fine.
It doesn't say it has to be an objectively good memory. Like,
it's just gotta be, it makes you really, like, morally happy. Good. It fills you with joy, which is why you can make them up too. If you just have a good enough imagination, you too can make a Patronus.
If you have a good enough imagination, you too can be happy.
That really makes Umbridge the most evil of all, because if all of the other Death Eaters and even Voldemort is not able to cast a Patronus, it's because they are not truly happy about what they do. So the
only... Like, why would they?
The only person who is happy about being evil is Umbridge.
She's the one happy about it. But I really have to wonder, because, you know, you say, oh yeah, Death Eaters can't cast Patronuses. Like, but do they try, though? Like,
have they ever tried?
Do they need to try? The Dementors listen. They just kind of take Voldemort's order. Like, yeah, this is fine. Like, they don't use their abilities.
And that's their vibe. They like to live in the darkness, so they don't need light.
They don't need light. Who needs to see?
We have dark vision.
Yeah, we're pretty much. But yeah, so that's my fun theory that I kind of keep throwing at the wall to see if the spaghetti sticks.
Well, I'm sold. Like, this is canon as far as I'm concerned.
My heart. That's fantastic. Heck yeah. We're converts.
Like, honestly, when I was reading through this earlier this week to kind of prepare for this, the paragraph about how the Obscurus acted totally to protect Credence, like the scream I scrumped, my husband was like, are you okay? I'm like, I'm fine! I'm just having feelings about Credence!
Big feelings. Like, yeah. The poor thing, like, absolutely deserves our pity.
I mean, it also makes it so sad that we don't have the true ending of history, because I mean, I totally buy everything that you say, but at the same time, it feels like if it's really that, we need to have Credence saved from the Obscurus. Yeah. So we need to have a way to heal. And because the magic exists, the magic that is the opposite side, and that is it exists, and it can, and so we really feel like they are so close at the end of movie three with the denominator, like I said, and with the fact that Credence made a choice and he didn't use the Obscurus to protect himself when Grindelwald attacked him. He was just, I don't know if he was ready to die or he was trust, and he really wanted to.
I mean, with everything going on, like, can you imagine just how hopeless that had to have felt? But, like, you know, in the third film, we see that magic. Like, we still see Credence using a wand. So he's channeling that magic. And it makes me wonder, because, you know, I'm all about wondering about Obscuruses, but it does make me wonder about, like, at what point, because if it's, the Obscurus is driven by subconscious desire and intent, and then gets acknowledged and is being utilized, and the magic is no longer being repressed, if that's an active, like, if there's a reintegration process, like with people who have dissociative identities who go through big emotional upheavals and are able to reintegrate those portions of themselves, that if Credence is doing this kind of process through these big emotional moments of trying to harness his magic and therefore not need a magic like the Obscurus. And I think that, you know, if we got to see, like, my thought for what Credence's story was going to be about was going to be about acknowledging having made stupid decisions and having gone through all these traumatic things and having to learn to accept that those things happened, and then also accept that different things and better things can happen moving forward, and acknowledging the people and the connections that were made in light of those things. So, like, thinking about, okay, well, here are the Dumbledores with Credence. What happens there? Is he going to accept that they are genuine people, or is he going to lash out at them as well? And what about all of those stages of grief are going to happen in regards to that? You know, I'm sure that if we continued in that line of him continuing to try to harness his magic and not rely on the Obscurus and work through his traumas, maybe he could have just been a powerful wizard on top of that. And maybe that's something that happens to other Obscurus and Obscurials, and why the magical world doesn't think they exist anymore.
Huh. Yeah, and at the same time that you were talking, I thought about another thing, that because we theorized about why Credence is dying in movie three when he was totally, he looked okay.
He was fine in two.
Yeah, so we had this theory that maybe, and you had this theory that maybe Grindelwald was making experimentation about maybe putting another Obscurus in him. But I wonder if maybe there is another explanation regarding what you said about why the Obscurus appear and how it acts to protect and to make this twisted connection with the being that created it. Maybe it's the fact that he used magic, that he used that he made this Obscurus channeled, that turned it into something that, like, maybe that's I don't know how to explain, but maybe that's the Obscurus not willing to, because that's antinomic, that having an Obscurus channel, because it's because he channeled the Obscurus that makes him sick and dying, because now that he can channel it, the Obscurus has no reason to be.
Like this, that separation between the conscious desire, like he wants to use magic, he wants to be a wizard, he wants to be part of this, he has the ability now, and the subconsciousness of all of the fear and everything that happened, and it has its own consciousness, it's been acting by itself for who knows how many years. It's like, you want to stop? You want to control me? Which would also kind of align with like that kind of Horcrux dichotomy where the bits of the soul act differently outside of the host.
Yeah.
Like that kind of separation where it's like, it's not fully a part of him anymore. It already started separating off. And so it's also fighting around.
Yeah. So that's so how to cure Credence would be like, you don't, I mean, you can't use the Obscurus, because the Obscurus, that's the reason why the Obscurus, you are an Obscurus, because you try to, I mean, it's a manifestation of the repressed magic. So you have to find your true magic and not the anger, and you have to find the light
If you start using it, then it stops being what it was. The reason that it was so destructive and powerful was because it had to use all of its force to escape from the earthly tether of the body to go and do what it was going to do to express itself. It built up over time like a champagne popper that the cork flew off and there goes the Obscurus. But if you're constantly trying to channel magic and utilize it, no matter how powerful that magic is, it's not going to have the same force that something under pressure is going to.
Yeah. And it also, Grindelwald made him use it not to totally, not to protect himself, but to attack, Dumbledore. And even if he tried to make Credence believe that Albus is responsible for everything everything in his life, I mean, he doesn't really believe that. So the fact that he used this magic to attack Dumbledore, it's not, the Obscurus must be like, I'm not, that's not why I'm here. That's not why I'm part of you. I'm here to protect you. So no, I will destroy you, because that's, that's.
If we're going to think about, the way that the Obscurus projects itself in the first place, its purpose, if it sees that, and all of it goes by evidence, like if you're looking at the actions that we see the Obscurus take, they're all based on direct actions, so direct consequences. So like, we don't know what those people whose building was destroyed in the very beginning of the first film did, but they probably did something. I'm pretty confident in saying that they did something stupid and cruel to Credence and the kids, but Dumbledore hasn't done anything that Credence has evidence of. So he just has Grindelwald's word, and he's seen the way that Grindelwald interacts with others and what he does, and ostensibly should also know bits and pieces about the kind of experiments that Grindelwald does in his own fortress. So he knows that there's duplicitous information out there. So what can he trust? What he knows and what he sees.
Wow. That's wow. It changed everything. I mean, I want to rewatch the movies now. that's so cool.
Yeah, there's just so many silly little details that I like to just like, okay, here's this little thing, but what if we just think about it for a minute? And yeah, here's an idea.
Yeah, and I said in, I mean, last episode, on the episode before, that Obscurus is like the most, from what, I think it was in the episode with Amy when we think about what we want to keep from this free movie and the cool addition to the world. And the Obscurus is, I think, the most interesting thing. And you just added so much more reason to believe that.
No, so, yeah, that concept, of everything that came out of the films, I do think the Obscurus is what I would want to keep and continue discussing and theorizing about.
It's fascinating.
Wow.
We're speechless.
Thank you, Dag. Holy cow. Okay, so now that we've all had our takes on the entire series, not 90 degrees to the left, shall we take a little trip into the Newt case?
Heck yeah.
Please.
Okay. Absolutely.
So, this week on the Newt case, we're doing something a little bit lighter. We are going to be talking about the Scottish folk creature Cat Cheese. And it is spelled cat, C-A-T, and then S-I-T-H. So it looks like cat sit, yes, but it's pronounced cat cheese.
I'm imagining because, yeah, of course, I'm again in the Star Wars period with Ahsoka. Just so I'm thinking about Sith cats, like.
No, I'm just like, Sith cat. Yep.
Wow, okay. Suddenly claws. I'm reminded that I'm so much older than everyone else here because I saw Cat Sith listed on the Wikipedia entry of Scottish folklore, and I was like, oh, like Cate Sith from Final Fantasy VII, which is why I picked it up, because Cate Sith.
Yeah, well, no, that's also fair, but, you know, the Sith
I didn't even think about Star Wars!
Star Wars as a concept is from the 80s.
I know.
Just, you know, Sith as a concept. That's the 80s. You know, just to Final Fantasy VII.
1997, I know.
Yeah, you know, 10 years later-ish.
Anyway, cat cheese.
Yes, cat cheese.
And I will link my sources in the show notes. I want to give a shout out to Timberbush Tours, Biddy's listing of Irish and Celtic folklore, and Kate Thulu's Cave of Mysteries for their information on cat cheese. So, cat cheese, the name comes from the Gaelic words cat, which means cat, and she, which is the term for fairies. It has all black fur, aside from a small white spot on its chest, and it haunts the Scottish Highlands.
Fantastic.
It is said to be close to the size of a large dog. So it could have just been a large black dog. And then you think, oh, that was definitely a cat. Maybe you're just not super familiar with animals. One of the theories about the cat she is that they aren't fairies, but they are witches that have the ability to transform back and forth between human form and cat form.
Oh, McGonagall.
Ooh.
Okay.
This... bad news for Minerva, could only be done nine times.
Oh. Yeah, called it.
With the final transformation into the cat being permanent.
Oh, so like a Maledictus.
Yeah, exactly. So this makes me think, okay, so is that what happened to Nagini? Like, she only has a limited number of transformations between Lady and Snake before Snake is permanent. What happens to McGonagall? Is she ever going to get stuck as a kitty?
I don't know. Isn't it, like, implied at some point that, like, if the Animagi aren't, like, if they don't keep their mind, then they become more like the animal until they just forget how to change back? I feel like I read that somewhere.
Maybe?
Wasn't there... yeah, there was something Sirius said where he was spending so much time as a dog or something.
He was starting to forget about what it was like to be human, like something like that. And then the way that Wormtail acts when he comes out of Scabbers, that he still has all those like kind of rat-like behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, back to fairies.
The Catchy are considered to be malevolent because they are considered to be soul thieves. The common belief is that the Catchy could pass over the corpse of the dead prior to burial and steal the soul before the gods claimed it.
For what purpose? What would they do with it? Does it give them more chances to turn back?
It never goes into hungry? Maybe they need a snack. Maybe they have like a hoard. Maybe they're bringing it back to the devil.
Maybe they just stolen souls look like.
Maybe they are collector. They put it in little bottle in the.
Or like Ursula style. Just have like the cave.
Oh yeah, like their little garden of souls.
Yeah, a little garden of souls. Yeah.
And this was the origin of the Wake to setting up a special watch to guard the dead. And this is in Celtic, so I apologize. I've been taking Celtic on Duolingo, but my pronunciation is still. So it is a special watch called the Fail Fadalach? Fadalach? I don't know. I'm sorry. To all of our Celtic listeners who just turned off the podcast, I'm sorry. That means late wake. Those on the watch would attempt to keep the Catchy away from the room containing the corpse by distracting it with a variety of methods, such as using catnip, riddles, games, and music. The thought is that if you have a whole good time going on in this room, the Catchy is going to be attracted to the noise and the light and the warmth, and not to the corpse.
Okay.
And the catnip.
Catchy like good times. Party hard.
I mean, my cat would definitely go to the quiet room, not the loud room, but okay.
Wait, is Luna black with a white spot on her chest?
Just cat, she don't have anxiety. That's the only way it works.
They were also believed to be fond of warmth, and therefore fires were not lit near the body, so that the way the cat, she were not attracted to the area. Although never to be trusted when encountered, legend also says that on the Feast of Samhain, which is like Halloween, the cat she would bless any house that left a saucer of milk out for it to drink.
Okay.
But the houses that did not leave out a saucer of milk got cursed.
Ooh.
So maybe your cow's milk would dry up, your horse would die, just something bad would happen because you screwed up, you didn't leave milk out for the fairies.
The thing you're most dreading.
Yeah. The thing you're most dreading come to pass. Lavender Brown is constantly terrified about her baby rabbit dying.
Even though she wasn't really scared about it until after it happened. But that's a whole other bag of worms.
And so research has shown that the Catchy may actually be based in fact. Because a lot of people believe that the origin of the Catchy may be the Kellis cat, which is a result of a Scottish wildcat mating with a domestic cat. And they're big. These are big boys. Like, if you look in the show notes, I linked a picture of a Kellis cat. If you look at this, the link is called "Oh Lord, He Coming."
Oh God!
Because if you look at that picture, God. Oh Lord, He Coming.
Yeah, He Coming.
He big.
That's a big cat.
So larger than a usual house cat, a big boy, and they do have different markings, but most of them are black with the white spot on their chest. Although there is no known record of a Kellis cat actually stealing a soul.
Well, how would you prove it? That's the question, is how would you prove it? They just look suspicious and now they're acting weird. They obviously
that's
stole
true
a soul.
Just like the Obscurus, just because it wasn't reported doesn't mean it
oh that's
happen.
True don't yep. tell cat cop stuff.
Yep, we don't tell cat cop stuff.
I just find that the Scottish wildcat, or also known as the Highland tiger. that's big cats, but that's still cats. So.
He's very, yeah,
not that
exactly.
Big.
It's just like cat.
Yeah, I would be like, all right, I will give you belly rubs, not run in the other direction.
So that is the cat she. I did that research because I am going to Edinburgh this year, and we're going to go to Loch Ness, so I'm going to go find my friend Nessie, and I'm also going to keep an eye out for the cat she when we're out on the Highlands.
Cool. So if you come back home and you start acting really weird, will know something's up and the cat, she got you.
Yeah, you'll know that I died in Edinburgh. Mm-hmm, the cat, she stole my soul. And then somehow I came back to life?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? We cannot question cat witch magics. I mean, necromancy is absolutely up their alley if they're messing with souls, so.
That is true. That's the nude case.
I love it. So that's it for this amazing episode, but we still have a question for you. So do you think Credence could be saved? And if so, how? And I want to hear what type of Patronus-linked cure you can come up with. And to find that, I also want to know what is your Patronus. So yes, tell us everything. So we'd love... So you can do that by sending us an owl on any of our social media outlets. And you can also send us an email at speakbeastie@gmail.com. And since you are on the internet, you can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and also on Spotify. I think you can do that now.
And once you are done leaving nice reviews for us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SpeakBeastie, Facebook.com at Facebook.com/SpeakBeastie. If you are one of these six people that are not bots that still use Tumblr, you can find us on SpeakBeastiePodcast.tumblr.com. And you can support the show on Patreon at Patreon.com/SpeakBeastie. Carolyn mentioned earlier, our graphic designer does amazing coloring pages. We have stickers. We get coasters. Coming soon, there is going to be some exclusive leaky content. Once I get it off my phone and get it edited, it's going to be awesome. I have videos from Rankin-Palooza and photos from the, like, from our perspective at the panel, and... it's great. It's great. You should sign up. It's $1 dragon a month. Well, $2 dragon a month for the exclusive stuff, but $2 dragon a month. Not bad.
All right. So that wraps us up. This was a great episode. Thank you so much, Dag, for coming on.
Oh my gosh. Wait, Dag. What? Where can our listeners find you on social if they want to learn more about your amazing theories?
Yeah, I'm all over the place. I currently only have 2 videos up from before the Panini pandemic BS happened, but I am Rocking Writer, but it's spelled like Wizard Rock, so it's WROCKING Writer, like writing. I have Gmail, Instagram, Tumblr, YouTube, and a Facebook page all under that, and I think that's it, actually. Yeah, that's where those are all of my social things. I'm all over the place. Do I post very often? Not right now, because I've recently just moved halfway across the country, but I am trying to be more active on all of those places. But I'm always up for random people messaging me to talk.
Awesome. Don't be afraid to approach like Anne.
Yeah. Yeah, don't be intimidated.
Yeah.
And do more podcasts, because I think it was your first, but you did so great. So
yes.
I hope
Can y'all believe that this was Dag's first podcast?
Yeah, my first podcast experience. And it was a lot of fun. So,
what a pro!
Yeah, looking forward to future things. So hoping more collaborations in the future. And maybe I'll explore it myself someday, but going to try to finish, you know, I started the YouTube channel. I should try to work with that a little bit.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on. We're honored that we're your first podcast experience. This was so much fun.
Yeah, it really was.
I'm Amy.
I'm Anne.
I'm Marjolaine.
And I'm Dag. Case closed.